Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. I am so glad you're joining us tonight. We have a wonderful sponsor. It's called Paws for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Paws for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. It is an amazing program. Go to www.pawsforpurplehearts.org. Okay, it's legal goo time. You are going to have some gooey gooies on you in just a moment. Get ready. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you get your true crime brain just a fury, don't take it out on the forums. You come to me because we heard it here on Trisha's True Crime Radio, okay? Okay. Coming up in just a bit, my co-host Michael in Minnesota will be joining us. Also, Shanna Hogan, author of Picture Perfect, the Jodi Arias story. She has some great scoop to give us about the background of that book. And later in the show, Telluride Police Chief James Kohler. Chief Kohler wrote A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey? And we do have a lot to talk about tonight with the chief because there is a lot happening with the JonBenet Ramsey case. But first, I decided to try an experiment tonight. I decided to meditate about the show. I told myself the first picture that came into my head while I was meditating was what I would use to start the show. In other words, if a fire truck came into my head, I'd talk about firefighters. If it was the moon, I might talk about astronauts. Or perhaps it would be something amazing and it was connected to the two cases we're going to talk about. Unfortunately, none of the normal things popped into my head while I meditated. No, no, no. The first thing that came into my brain when I went deep into meditation were the Oompa Loompas making chocolate using a conveyor belt from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Now, I could attribute this weird vision to a flashback from Magic Mushrooms I took in 1980, or I could try and see if it was really connected to my show. I started laughing because it was just ridiculous, and that made me think of Paula Woodward's book about the Ramseys. It's coming out in 2014. Now, Paula's book is the same thing over and over and over again, just like a conveyor belt with chocolates on it, and it is laughable. Woodward is a local news anchor and a good friend of the Ramseys. The Ramsey family fully cooperated with Woodward in writing this book, and she says it took 4 years to write. Now, to me, it's laughable because we know it's going to be the same ridiculous intruder baloney we keep hearing from the Ramsey side over and over. I will be stunned if Woodward's book is not a laughable rehashing of the same old, same old, same old from Ramsey camp. Reminds me of fiction. Say, an Oompa Loompa making the same chocolate over and over again. You see, my meditation worked. My weird vision fit perfectly with my show. And then again, it really could be those magic mushrooms from 1980. I just don't know. Let's go to Michael in Minnesota. Michael, are you there, my dear?
Hi, Trisha.
Hi, hello.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you. Let's go to Shanna. I believe this is Shanna. Shanna, are you there?
Yes, it's me.
How
for
are
having
you?
Me, Trisha.
Oh, you
great.
Are very,
are you?
Very welcome. I'm doing great. Okay, first of all, this is a little bit delicate for me because I don't want this show to come across as, you know, one of those gotcha shows where we just like to report the dirt. But let's face it, sometimes the dirt, as they call it, is interesting. And Shanna, I've gotten to know you. You are a kind, sincere, very loving person, and you do things out of caring for others. You really do. And I think when people like you come into the world, sometimes it's shocking the way people treat you. Now, first of all, tell us, is there anything new in the Jodi Arias case? And then we'll get to writing the book, okay? Is there anything new? What's the latest going on?
Well, we're waiting to know when the retrial will start, and so we're all kind of in limbo waiting to see if it's going to go in February like we're hoping. I mean, now we're almost coming up on a year from when it started, and we still don't have a sentence. And it's very heartbreaking for the families, you know, to not have any conclusion here. So it's kind of just been a waiting period for that.
Have you heard anything about Jody behind bars? Is she just loving life? What's the story on that?
You know, she seems to make the best out of her circumstances and seems to be pretty content. You know, she carries on with the Twitter, selling her artwork, talking to family members. All things I've heard is that she's doing fine. She gets fan mail, quite a bit of it in jail, and seems to be, you know, adjusting quite well, and will probably end up being better off in prison where the conditions are much better.
You know, I'm looking at something that Michael in Minnesota, our co-host, put up in the chat room. Michael, this makes my eyes spin in my head like a slot machine. It's a message from Jody Arias. Where did you get this? It's just this long
babbling. It was posted. Sky, yeah, Sky was the one. She sent me a text and said, have you seen the letter Jody's written? And, of course, I knew nothing about it. And so she sent me to the State versus Jody Arias Facebook page. And that's where they posted it. And it is essentially, she's calling to arms her supporters to go after the people she calls or labels the haters, and make sure to document and screenshot, save, and report any kind. She claims that a lot of her supporters are having to use pseudonym names or I'm just tongue-tied tonight, and forgive me for that. Aliases, because they are being threatened with bodily harm and death, and so she's calling everyone to report everything to authorities. And I just know Shanna mentioned in her monologue or whatever that she's receiving all of this fan mail. I'm just outraged by it. Who out there didn't watch the trial and see the photograph of what she did to Travis? And what
Michael, can you hold on one second?
Who's
doing dishes or cleaning or hitting pans together? Who's doing that?
My husband was. I will move out of the room.
Okay. Tell him I will have to come out there and smack him. I have gotten on planes before and smacked people and turned right around again. So,
I'm moving out of the other room. I was in the kitchen.
Thank you. Thank you. But, Michael, you're absolutely right. I mean, who out there watched that trial and thought, hey, I'm going to write Jody Arias. I think she's a wonderful person. It's just appalling, isn't it?
Well, it makes no sense to me. And, I mean, we saw the true Jody Arias in the trial, who without the aid of modern-day beauty products, such as hair dye and makeup, is nothing but a dog. So I can't quite understand what there is appealing about her. I mean, the fact that she can't tell the truth if her life depends on it makes her unappealing in and of itself. The fact she trashed Travis and his good name and reputation without a single ounce of remorse, she was gleeful in it, I almost believe. I don't know. On Beth's radio show, she was talking to the Robert Blecker, who we're going to be talking with on the 12th of January. Right.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about the death of punishment. And it just, to me, he has an idea that everyone that commits a murder should be treated the same. There's no punishment in our jail system except if you act up while you are in the prison system. And so, therefore, the only punishment meted out is for contraband or talking back to authority or attacking a guard or an inmate or something. That's when you receive punishment. Otherwise, there's no such thing. But he feels like murderers, anyone with a life sentence, should be subjected to the very same living conditions in prison of those who are being punished for actions behind bars that get them put up in solitary confinement. He talks about a Nutriloaf that is just a foodstuff that gives you everything you need. It's tasteless, but it provides your daily requirements. I mean, plus he thinks that they should all have pictures of their victims. He didn't say if they should be the crime scene photos, autopsy photos, or just the person in life. I would suggest both. Out of reach, of course. So these people are faced with their handiwork day in, day out, with no way to escape, so they can sit there and think about what they've done. And that, I find, would be just punishment.
Now, for Jody, especially.
For Jody, especially. And I don't believe we should have to hear from her these rambling letters and her tweets. And that needs to be cut off.
Maybe I agree.
I don't know, no one's talking up in the...
You've got to go see.
Like, they agree me, but.
But no, I agree 100%. Here's the thing: you've got to see this letter, so you can understand what Michael's talking about. You can go to the Facebook page, State of Arizona versus Jody Arias. I'm not sure what the exact address is, but it's up there. I guess that's Jody's Facebook page, and read it. And it's just this rambling, long, awful thing. Shanna, you've read it. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think Michael makes a good point, and one of the only ways that she'll start losing her power is if we all kind of stop paying her attention and, you know, stop making, blowing up these emails. And she can write to someone, but if no one cares to read it, it doesn't matter anymore. And
exactly.
So that's the only thing that cures that is the passage of time. And we all move on to another case and another, you know, shocking thing. And then time passes and the people who love Travis remember him and doesn't associate Jody with Travis anymore.
Just slap me. Shanna, when you wrote about Jody Arias, let's talk about the beginning of your book, Jody Arias, Picture Perfect, the story of Jody Arias. It's on Web Sleuths, on a rolling Amazon ad. You can get it there. I'd highly recommend it. It is a fascinating look into the life of Jody Arias. You talk to a lot of people, and you really got the good background. But let's talk about the book itself. When did you decide to write a book, and how did that happen?
So I had been a journalist in Arizona for since 2004, and had written another book and on another crime case involving a female murderer. I'd always wanted to write books. I never knew that I would get into true crime, but I'd always been interested in crime and followed the shows that Dateline and 48 Hours Mysteries, and especially was interested about local cases. So I had started writing about the Jody case in 2009 and researching it. My first article came out in 2010. And from there, I knew right away I'd want to make it a book. So I got the book deal, I think, in 2010 or maybe late 2010, and was waiting for the trial from then.
May I interrupt here, and maybe you're giving away trade secrets, and I certainly don't want you to do that, but when you say you got the book deal, how does one go about getting a book deal? I mean, they're few and far between these days. They really are, right?
No, I don't mind giving away trade secrets. Yeah, for me, I always wanted to write books, and so when I started covering the case that became my first book, I didn't know how to write how to get a book deal, so I read everything I could. And I read books on how to write book proposals and books on how to get literary agents and how to actually write it, and then read everything I could on just books in general that were true crime books, and to see how it was put together, and put together a book proposal and sent it out to every literary agent that represented true crime. And my agent ended up signing me, and she got a couple different offers for deals, and we signed with St. Martin's Press. And so when I wanted to do the second book, I spent about 3 months working on the proposal for the Jody Arias case, put it together, and with examples of my background, my writing, and everything, and St. Martin's Press signed up for that too. So it's a lot of work for not a lot of money, especially in the beginning, and it's a lot of struggle, and you have to really, really want it, because it's just a ton of work.
It's a lot of work. We have some things I want to read to you from the chat room, Shanna. Ollie, too, wrote, Shanna, I really enjoyed your book and how you attributed so many chapters to Travis and how wonderful he was. And Cubby Girl said, ditto, great read, and I think everybody agrees with that. So your hard work is definitely appreciated. So you get the book deal. Okay, and you start working on it. Now, we're going to talk about something that happened that you weren't able to talk about the last time you were here. But I think it's very important for people to know what goes on behind the scenes and just how really cutthroat this business is. You start
kind of,
writing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's an interesting backstory, like what we're going to tell tonight. And it wasn't that I couldn't talk about it. I wasn't barred from talking about it. I didn't want to, but I talked to Michael a lot, and he kind of convinced me that, you know, I should, and I told him that if I felt like I ever wanted to, I would do it on your show, and I'm only doing it now because enough time has passed that it doesn't really matter anymore, but it is an interesting backstory into the business and what kind of goes on behind the scenes, so...
Okay, let's talk about that. Let's just let you tell your story. Everybody listen closely. This is Shanna Hogan. She is the author of Picture Perfect, the Jodi Arias story. And Shanna has a very interesting backstory about what happened to her. And it involves someone that I think we all know. So, Shanna, go right ahead.
Well, like I said, I was very blessed to get the book deal. And because I started writing about it so early, I was able to get a lot of these people, these great sources that were able to talk with me and ended up becoming friends with people like Sky Hughes and another friend gave me some recordings of Travis and his life and entrusted me with them, and I've never given them to anyone else because he didn't want those released out in the public. And so it helped to put together the book the way I wanted to, because I was able to devote a lot of time to Travis, which is what I wanted to do in the book. I actually would have called it the Travis Alexander story, but my publishers decide, you know, what's going to sell. And at that point, Jodi was very hot, you know, the topic. So they put the Jodi Arias story. Just another side note, the cover actually changed multiple times as it went and it became more popular, and then they realized they didn't even have Jodi's name on it. So they had tried to put Jodi's name on it. So at the time, my agent is a really good literary agent. Her name is Charlene Martin. She's represented a lot of well-known authors and, you know, helped them become New York Times bestsellers, and including the Ron Goldman's family. She represented them in getting the book rights back from O.J. Simpson on the I Did It book that he had wrote.
Oh, wow.
So that was published in behalf of the Ron Goldman family, and they got the proceeds from that. So she was the person who ended up getting that back from them. So at the time, she represented me, and she represented Jane Velez Mitchell. And to facilitate, promotion of the book, she actually told Jane about the case and connected me with Jane and ended up becoming a regular guest on her show starting in 2012.
Okay, can I stop you just one second here? Yes. Can I just stop you one second, Shanna? So
yeah.
I just want to make sure I've got this right. So your agent has you, and she also represents Jane Velez Mitchell, right? And
yes.
So it was her idea for you to go on Jane's show, and Jane was very happy to have you on the show, correct?
Yes.
It was
mutually beneficial to everyone. It became a forum for me to talk about the case. So almost nightly throughout the trial, once it finally started, almost nightly I went to, and a lot of people who watched the trial will probably remember I was a frequent guest and watched the show. And I went from the courtroom to the trailers outside the courtroom where I, you know, did her show. And talked for hours, and sometimes I would sit there, and they would come to me, not at all, and I would stay there the whole show. And towards the middle, Jane's always about breaking scoops and everything. Oh, in the beginning, I gave them, I'd purchased the police report early on. I gave them a copy of it to try and help. I gave that to a couple of people to help in their reporting. And, I mean, that's an expensive documents, like about $500 document because of the way they cost and per page, and had just really been just trying to be as helpful as possible. and then had towards the middle when there wasn't any exclusive information breaking, the producers would call me and I would give them exclusive information. I would give them tips and stuff to help out the show and break news.
Jane Velez Mitchell's producers would call you.
Yeah, and they were breaking news on the show that was exclusive to me. I broke the story about the ring that was stolen. I broke the story that Jody was originally on a trip to, that she was originally scheduled to go to Cancun with Travis, and that trip that she was actually on the passenger list and it was taken off, and that was right after Jody had testified that she was never going to Cancun. And they actually had me write a thing for their website on it. And so all this happens, and again, being helpful, and then I find out that she's also writing a book on the case. So,
so
you can
she was
my
benefiting
shock.
From all of your extensive research expense. You'd been working on the case since 2010, and everything you had gathered, you shared with Jane Velez Mitchell. Lo and behold, she essentially absconds or purloins everything you've discovered and uses it for her own book. And that is just appalling. Go ahead.
And didn't she rush? Didn't she rush to get it out before yours, or is that not true?
Oh, yeah. And clearly mine was overshadowed by hers because she's way more famous than me, and she had a nightly talk show to promote it. So, you know, a lot of people ended up buying her book because of, you know, that. I mean, it probably outsold mine. I'm not really sure.
What did your agent say?
Awesome,
she represented both you and Jane Velez Mitchell. What did she say?
My agent is awesome and incredibly great reputation and honest and true. And she found out, she dropped Jane as a client, and she ended up sending her a message that copied me on it afterwards that said, because of what Jane had done, she would not be recommending any clients to do her show in the future.
Wow. Now
she stood by me.
And that's the thing we have to understand here, because let's dial it back here just a minute. I'm gonna take the devil's advocate side here, and what Jane Velez Mitchell might say is, "Hey, I can decide to write a book. There's nothing wrong with that. I just decided.
Oh yeah.
I've decided a long time ago to write a book. I can do it myself." But your agent even recognized that here you were giving all this information, proprietary information that wasn't going to anybody else but Jane. And then she announces a book and pushes it out right before yours, knowing the reason that you're on her show is to get ready to promote this book. That's why it's so unbelievably wrong. Is that a good way
of
looking
at
it?
It's appalling. It's appalling.
Yeah.
Absolutely appalling.
You guys...
And thank God, your agent told you, do not do Jane's show anymore, correct?
Yeah, she did, and I stopped, obviously, around the time that she announced that she was doing a book, I stopped doing it. I don't know Jane's position, and again, I don't think harshly about other people. You know, like I said, I agreed to tell the story just because enough time had passed that it doesn't really matter anymore. You know, it's like book wars, I guess. And like you said, there's always more than one book on popular cases, so that was not a shock to me. I knew that there would be another book. It was a little shocking that it was Jane, but like I said, I don't know where she was coming from or her background and all of that. I know she had written books before, so, you know, I don't, it ended up working well because she did promote my book in the beginning, but that was just the backstory and that few people knew that I would tell you. I'm not upset about it. Like, I didn't expect the case to ever be huge. When I signed up, I didn't think it would ever end up being a hardcover book. I thought that my book would end up being a mass market paperback, like my first one. And then it became a huge case. I remember telling everyone about who Jody Arias was for years before she became so well known. And so it ended up working out beneficially to me, but it just is the way the book business works. It's very competitive and kind of an interesting backstory.
did your agent ever hear from Jane Velez again?
I'm not sure. We never really talked about it after that.
Because here's the thing. I don't know agents. I don't know anything about them. But it wouldn't surprise me if an agent said, Well, honey, you know, Jane's writing a book. She's a bigger client than you are. I'm going to have to go with Jane Vanellis Mitchell. I'm sorry, I have to drop you. I mean, I could see an agent being scummy like that, but your agent stood by you, and she dropped a very big client on the basis of principle.
And that is the people who have a really great reputation and a really honorable character in the business, and versus those who don't. And my agent, again, Charlene Martin, Martin Literary Management, is just a very reputable and awesome, and she treats like all her clients like they are her big clients. And, yes, I was not as well-known as Jane was Mitchell in any way, and still she stood beside me, and I would have understood if she hadn't, because Jane was bigger. So that's a little bit of a shout-out to her for
and
absolutely. I am so happy about this. I can't even tell you. And I stopped watching Jane after I heard this story. I absolutely refuse. I find it just appalling to rush her book out. As I remember those early shots of you, Shanna, and they always said, author of Picture Perfect. You know, she knows everything about this case inside and out. So they did promote you initially, but then all of a sudden she gets this wild idea that, hey, I can also write a book and hopefully get it out. I know that she had people working with her that also contributed to the book and feel terrible about the way it was handled. So I have to say
the producers on the show, and they have nothing to do with that. They were great,
right.
And they were just doing what they were told to do. They didn't know what anyone else's intentions were when it came to books. And so I don't fault anyone. And like I said, just an interesting backstory in the world of publishing.
If you had to say something to Jane Vanellis Mitchell, what would you say to her, Shanna?
I don't like harbor any bad feelings, but I would just say that that it wasn't a very classy thing to do. But
there you go.
I guess that's all I would say.
And that is.
I love what someone's written in the chat room. Well, it was a pretty enormous principle in literary terms, since it amounts to deliberate plagiarism, which is more than literal and can involve the ideas of others. That's exactly what she did. She essentially plagiarized all your
I don't think she plagiarized. I don't think she took any of my actual words. And like I said, the case became public domain once it hit the courtrooms, and so anyone was able to write a book. Anyone could have written a book, and there's several little e-books on the case. So,
Shanna, did you read her book, and did you find anything that was in your book exclusively, and in Jane Vanellis Mitchell's book as well?
You know, I did not read her book. I could not. I could not stomach it. It came out about a month before mine. They pushed out my deadline up by a month to get it out sooner. And then all over my home state in Arizona, her book was at my grocery store and at Costco, and it just broke my heart. And so I couldn't pick it up. I couldn't read it, and I don't really have any intention to. I was kind of sick of the case by then, too. I didn't really want to spend my time reading it and obsessing over it. And
I understand. Michael, I'm going to let you take over for a moment while I get our next guest on the line, and then I'll come back and we'll wrap it up with Shanna, okay?
Okay. Very good. Shanna, I just cannot believe, first of all, I want to say, there is no comparison between your two books. I only scan through Jane's out of curiosity, but the way you write, and I've told you this personally and I've said it, you are my new favorite author, and the way you're able to paint a picture so beautifully. You don't just report facts as if you're reading a police report. It actually reads like a beautifully done work of fiction, you know, and to think it's true. Oh.
Well, thank
Did
you
I call
very
someone?
Much, Michael.
We must hear Trisha's phone dialing.
Hello?
Oh, that must be James Kohler. Hello, James Kohler.
Good evening.
I don't know what Trisha's doing.
Well, I'll just say that in terms of everything the way it happened, it wasn't a great thing why it happened, but I still feel like everything worked out well for me and feel very blessed to have a book published and to be in the position where I am. And I only decided after enough time had went by that I didn't feel any emotion to it, that it was just something that was, that, you know, this happened and it existed and that there's nothing I could do about it, that you kind of convinced me to tell the background story. But I really don't. I don't care that much. And
I'm just glad that you decided to tell. And, Michael, thank you for talking to Shanna for us, because I think when someone is a public figure and they do something that is shocking like that, I think it needs to be talked about, because you can't go on and pretend to be a caring person and turn around and do something like that to somebody. I think that was very cruel and very unclassy, if that is a word. So, Shanna, what's next in store for you? What's next on your plate?
Well, yeah, the real reason I really wanted to come on the show was to announce that I'm doing a third book, and it will be out. I'm working on it now. It's on the Martin McNeil case in Utah. And just signed up for that, and that was a really riveting case, and it's the first time I've broken out from Arizona to do an outside of Arizona case. So I'm working very diligently on that, and I plan to have that out next year.
That sounds wonderful. I cannot wait to read that book.
Oh,
don't go on
so
Jane's
happy
show, though.
That you were, I'm so happy you were able to talk about that. I was going to ask you myself, but I didn't know if you were ready to spread the word, but I'm so happy
I will.
For you, Shanna.
No problem.
Well,
thank you much for having me.
And you know that, Shanna, you can come on our show anytime you want, okay? And we'll help you any way we can.
Thank you so much, Tricia. Thank you so much,
thank
Michael.
You. You guys take
my
care now.
My pleasure, honey. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. I appreciate you and your honor, and you're just wonderful. Thank you.
She is. Thanks, Shanna. Okay, Michael. Boy, that was... I knew the story. I knew what was coming, Michael, but I was still stunned. It still bothers me. It really bothers
terribly.
Me. I mean, wow. I would like to ask Jane Velez Mitchell, how could you do that? How could you have a young woman on your show? You know she's writing a book. You have the same agent, and she's giving you all this amazing information. She's helping your ratings because that's the go-to show. And then, boom, you say, oh, I'm writing a book on the same topic, too. And the fact that her agent, that Jane Velez Mitchell's agent, dropped her over this speaks volumes. So I hope if it was done somehow unintentionally, I hope Jane Velez Mitchell will try and make it right. Or maybe she doesn't care. I just don't know. Okay, Michael, we are up next, and this is going to be a big one. We have Telluride Police Chief James Kohler. He is our guest. Chief Kohler is the author of A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey. Now, I did ask former Boulder Detective Steve Thomas to join us. He was unable to. Never fear, my friends. I shall continue my quest to guilt trip Steve Thomas into coming on our show again, and he will. He will. But the good news is, Chief Kohler, I rarely have to guilt trip you. You usually are very, very good. I don't have to pull out the guilt tripping hardly ever. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure.
And we have a lot of callers already. We have a lot of people in the chat room. But Chief Kohler, let's talk a little bit. And you weren't here, but I did mention Paula Woodward's book at the beginning. And I find this very, very interesting that the grand jury indictments come out. Your book came out first, grand jury indictments. You know, the tide is turning once again back to reality in that there was no intruder. And now Paula Woodward is coming out with a book. Do you know what the hell she could say that could convince anybody it was an intruder? I mean, what has she got to say?
I'm not sure. She reached out to me about a year ago via email, and I ended up having a phone conversation with her. It was rather interesting initially. I think what prompted her to reach out to me was to confirm the information that I'd put in my one of my chapters, that the acronym WWPWS, what would Paula Woodward say, on a blackboard or a dry erase board, and she wanted to find out whether or not that was accurate information. I said yes, it was, and
wow.
we had some small talk about her project. She's been working on this for 2 or 3 years, I think. It was my recollection that this book was going to come out sometime this fall. So it looked like it had been delayed if they're now saying it's going to be August of 2014. But that's kind of my involvement with Paul's discussion on that topic.
And let's just briefly touch over the grand jury indictments. We've already talked about them, but basically it came out, and to me it read like, and this is just my interpretation, and I can't believe I don't have them in front of me. I should have brought them in front of me, and I don't have them. But to me it read like the grand jury was saying that the Ramseys were protecting somebody. Am I getting the right impression from those indictments? Is that how it sounded to you too?
Well, the charges that they indicted on led me to believe that they suspected, the grand jurors suspected, that somehow the parents were involved in some type of cover-up. Mm-hmm. They did not go so far as to indicate who was the perpetrator of the crime, but that the parents knew or had information about what had occurred and chose to obstruct the investigation and cover it up, entering into conspiracy in that fashion.
Chief Kohler, you wrote the book that we all love. To me, it's the Bible of the case, and it's you can get it on Amazon, on our Amazon rolling ad on Web Sleuth. It's A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey. What has been I don't want to use the word fallout, but the reaction, has there been anything negative that has happened because of this book that you wrote?
That's a hard question to answer. I'm not quite sure if you're referring to publicity about the book and
well, just
and some
anything.
Of the things that were
just
presented
was,
there.
Is it did was anything when you wrote the book? Did you get anything negative coming back at you? I mean, sure, you had complaints and things like that, but was there anything that made you just go, "Oh, yeah, man, that's just bad. I don't know why that happened." You know, just. What happened in a negative way, if anything?
Well, I read reviews on Amazon, and I receive emails from people from time to time, Facebook postings. Some of the complaints was that it could have been edited a little bit more professionally, and I entirely agree with that. Despite my best efforts and my editor's efforts, there were some grammatical errors and other small errors that were subsequently corrected.
Oh, you know, people need to get over that. Big deal. I mean, you spent your own money. Let me just refresh everybody's memory. You spent your own money on this. You paid for everything. You did not have a publisher at all. And you did it yourself, basically. And it's cost you, I mean, I don't even want to venture to guess how many tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars that it has cost you. You've not made any money. And if you do make money, you're donating it. So you did not write this book for any other reason other than to get the truth out. You were working for the Boulder District Attorney's Office when Mary Lacey was there as the lead investigator in the JonBenet Ramsey case. And what you saw in that office during this investigation was appalling, and which was one of the reasons you've said you've written the book. So if anybody has a problem with a couple of grammatical errors, big deal. Get over it. This is a much bigger picture. So you just send them to me, Chief Kohler. I'll deal with them. They'll be quiet after I'm done with them.
I think one of the other complaints was that people expected me to point the finger at someone in particular and accuse them of being the murderer. And, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, due to prior lawsuits on the part of the Ramsey family, that wasn't advisable. And I had legal advice, you know, obviously through the writing of this, and there were a lot of different edits that took place over the period of time that this was being brought to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the complaints I think I've heard, aside from some of the editorial comments, and that is that, you know, I didn't name the person who's responsible. I think if you follow the evidence, I think you can come to the same conclusion as I did without having me to name somebody in specifically.
Chief Kolar, I want to read what somebody has written in the chat room. I want to give you this message. It's from Cubby Girl. She says, thank you, Chief Kolar, for an amazing book that was written from your heart. Who cares about grammar in this case? You brought the truth forward. And somebody else, Ollie too, also wrote, I really enjoyed the fact that you did not point the figure. To me, this is a true non-biased book. You can follow the evidence for yourself. My co-host, Michael in Minnesota, has a question. Then we're going to take some phone calls here. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, Chief Kolar, when we're talking, Trish is asking about fallout. Did you ever hear from John Ramsey or his attorney about this book?
I never did. They just seemed to discount the work and the publication of it and the release of the information that came from the investigative files, which I think was
well, here's the thing.
I think
that
they're just waiting for me to go away, I guess, is something that Trish has indicated in the past.
Here's the thing that people have to remember. The Ramseys were not shy about suing. They would sue anybody. And you got to remember, you can't sue when someone tells the truth. And rather, they've never even said, you know, we're going to take you to court. How dare you do this? Da da da. They've kept quiet about it. I mean, how many times did the Ramseys, they sued Steve Thomas, they've sued the tabloids. You know, hell, they were upset at one of my members for posting something and came after us. I mean, they're not afraid to go after people. That's what they do. And the fact, Chief Kolar, that the Ramseys, you haven't heard a thing from them or their attorney, to me, that silence is golden, and it speaks volumes. Okay, we're going to go to some of our regular callers when Chief Kolar calls in, and let's go to Cynic. Cynic is the brilliant poster on both websleuths.com and forumsforjustice.org who does the most amazing work. I mean, this man, I wish I could clone him and have a million Cynics running around because the work you do is amazing. Cynic, thank you for joining us today, and what is your question for Chief James Kolar?
That's quite a lead-in.
Yes, it is.
I agree, well, Cynic.
Thanks, James, and it's good to have you on the show again. I did catch you on a on another interview, the interview by CNN, shortly after the release of the indictment information. And you were asked, among other questions, something to the effect that what evidence was missing that prevented the case from going forward. I know that I think you said something to the effect that was a complicated question, and you proceeded to answer it. I would say that that's it's somewhat of a terrible question, really, because to anyone that knows the people involved, most notably Alex Hunter, wouldn't it, in your opinion, pretty much have taken a video of the crime or a confession, you know, from John or Patsy or one of the other players to have caused this case to go forward?
Well, I don't know. You know, Hunter's office had a history of negotiating plea deals in felony cases, not just in, you know, felony robbery or other things, but, you know, some of the murder cases they handled. And it seemed to me, in my recollection of events, that it was very infrequent that they went to trial in those types of situations. I don't know exactly, you know, what he thought he needed to go forward for a trial in this matter following the indictments, but for some reason he didn't feel it was there. I think Michael Caine, who was one of the lead prosecutors on the grand jury inquiry, was very disappointed. I think I've heard from other people that other prosecutors felt that they might have gone forward with it, but for whatever reason, Alex Hunter's office chose not to do so.
Does that answer your question, Cynic? Do you have a follow-up?
Well, no. I think a lot of people on the forums have their, you know, have formed their opinions of of Alex Hunter. You know, as have I, and you know, as James Kolar, I'm sure. It's, you know, when I hear things like that, it is frustrating to me because you know, I think if Well, not only is James' book an excellent, book to read on this case, and it's certainly, a virtual encyclopedia with respect to the JonBenet case. But Steve Thomas's book is also excellent in terms of certainly some of the backstory on the case, sort of the politics involved, and some of the difficulties that the Boulder Police Department had with dealing with the district attorney's office at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the shady and the less than, less than honest dealings, I think, that that Alex Hunter had with people and with cases. And the Smyka case, I think, is just a perfect example of the kind of person that Alex Hunter is, and perhaps some of the types of dealings that went on in that case. And I think even the fact that the Ramseys were not called to the grand jury, I think likely because there was a deal involving those 1998 interviews in exchange for
mm-hmm.
not being called, I think is just another example of the kind of person that Alex Hunter is, and the reason that the case did not go forward.
Exactly. So, Nick, you'll stay with us, right?
Oh, sure.
Okay, I'll go back to you in just a little bit, my dear. But Chief Kohler, let's talk about Alex Hunter and the Smyka case. Is that how you pronounce the person's name? Is it Smyka?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yes. Can you tell us the background on that? Because Cynic mentioned it, and I know there are some listeners out there now who don't know what happened. This was Robert Redford's daughter's fiance that we're talking about, and Alex Hunter did something that was so egregious, I can't even stand to think about it. But Chief Kohler, I want you to explain it because you know so much more than I do about it. So go ahead. What about the Smyka case?
Well, it was an execution-style homicide, is what the coroner's office, I believed, at the time. It was a shotgun.
Smyka. Smyka was killed.
Yeah. No, Smyka was the suspect.
The suspect.
Right, right. And I can't, it's been a long time, Tricia, so I don't remember all the details. He was either friends with or maybe the roommate of the victim in that case. And what struck me about the circumstances, and I may have mentioned this during one of the previous interviews that we've done on your program, was not long after the time that the grand jury had convened in that matter, I was a member of the Boulder Police Benefit Association, which is kind of like a bargaining unit for contract matters. And some materials that had been developed from the investigation came into our hands accidentally, and it was an agreement between defense attorneys and Alex Hunter's office not to ask certain questions of one or more witnesses. I apologize, I can't remember all the details.
That's fine.
During the grand jury inquiry. And that just struck us as very odd that, you're trying to get to the bottom of a murder investigation and you're agreeing with defense attorneys, what and what may not be asked during an inquiry before the grand jury. And we debated as to how we should handle that information, how or if it should be released. And eventually the decision was made that it was just too complicated an issue and it was never raised. It's too bad we didn't do that at the time. Perhaps there would have been an earlier resolution to the case. I can't see for certain because, Hunter was in office for a number of years, followed by Mary Lacey, and it wasn't until Stan Garnett came along and worked with Boulder PD and resurrected that case and went ahead and issued an arrest warrant for Smyka in that
mm-hmm.
homicide. He's still at large somewhere if he's alive, if he hasn't already passed on. So hopefully maybe one day he'll be brought to justice based on the warrant and work that Boulder PD and the Stan Garnett's office has completed.
So basically what happened was they let a murderer walk out and skip the country. And when it comes right down to it, that's exactly what they did. And the victim was Sid Wells, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So and that Sid Wells was Robert Redford's daughter's fiance. So and you have an execution-style murder, and you have the DA. I think about your DA people, your local DA or assistant DAs. Think about them. Hell, think about the ones on TV. Can you see them going to the attorney of an execution-style killer and letting him walk away. I mean, it's just, every time I hear that story, Chief Kohler, I can't believe it. I keep thinking they're leaving out some big part piece of this picture, but they're not. It is that outrageous and ridiculous. Chief Kohler, we have another one of your admirers who's here and has been holding quite a while. This is Cold Case. Cold Case, my dear, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. And we have Chief Kohler here. So, Cold Case, you go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I was all composed and ready to ask my questions, and you had to bring up the Smica case and go into detail, and now I'm in a slow burn.
Oh, dear. No,
I'm having to control myself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'll just follow through with the thing that of which you are all speaking right now. And I wondered, Chief Kohler, if you knew about these indictments. I know you couldn't talk about the grand jury or reveal information about the grand jury in your book or in your interviews prior to these being released by a judge, but, you know, perhaps you could mention, you could speak to that now if you knew it, you know, while you were working in as an investigator with the DA about these indictments of John and Patsy by the grand jury.
Yes, I was aware of them, but I'm unable to comment any further beyond that.
Right. Well, I just wondered because, you know, it's hard for those of us who don't work inside an office, an investigative department like that, exactly what you had access to and what you didn't. So I really wondered about that. And let me ask you one more question about the evidence in this case, which you may or may not be able to speak to, because, you know, I'm always just probing for the pieces of this puzzle that we don't have, and I know there are pieces that no one has except whoever was involved that night, but we hear occasionally from people like Peter Bowles or you know, just general knowledge of how investigators work within investigating a case, there's always something that is held back, something that's kept close to the vest, you know, to determine suspects and whether they're lying or, like John Mark Carr, you know, just trying to jump into a public, on a public bandwagon. But is there anything, I mean, we've heard also Mary Lacey said, other people have said, even Beckner recently said, you know, so much of this case is known now that it couldn't be solved or whatever. Is there still evidence in this case or information that is important to the case that the public doesn't know about, of which you can speak?
You know, that's a good question. I can't think of anything of any huge importance that that is still outside the public arena that would help identify a true confessor, if that's what you're asking. You know, when you talk about John Mark Carr, when I finally heard what type of email correspondence he was having, I said he doesn't have his forensics correct. He couldn't have been responsible for this. And that was the big question I had was, you know, what exactly was he claiming to have done? And it was all fantasy, in my opinion, when that finally came to light. So I think if someone is going to come forward and confess, they could probably provide details about how events unfolded that evening and then some of the evidence that has been collected and debated would make sense to people. I think that's what it's going to take.
A good example, I think, with Cold Case, a good example would be explain the flashlight and the batteries in the flashlight. Why were they wiped down? You know, and if they could come up with the reason for that or who did it and why, then that would be, you know, something that they could, that the police could hang their hat on, so to speak, to say, well, yeah, this guy knows what he's talking about. But that's a good question. Cold Case, do you have any more? We have a little time.
Well, you know, who is the lady that worked for the tabloids who was on Forms for Justice for
Donna.
A long time? Yes.
Yes.
She once wrote that there is more evidence of sexual abuse, prior sexual abuse, that the public doesn't know about. Of course, this has been many years ago now. So that was that kind of thing, you know, if there is something being held back. And Peter Bowles recently said, well, within the last year since these indictments came out, that there is one more piece of evidence he knows about or claims to know about that is very damning and has never been revealed. Just that kind of thing. If there, you know, if there's something that is not being disclosed to the public at this point, that would be important in identifying what happened.
He hasn't indicated what that is. Is that correct?
Oh no.
Okay.
That would just
they just,
be
they
too
just
good,
people just
wouldn't
tease
it?
Us. People just tease us, Chief Kohler. It's terrible.
Oh.
But I don't know if you can speak to that, or I because if you said yes, there is more evidence, then everybody's ears would perk up. But if you said no, I mean, I don't know. What can you say to that? You already answered
it once. I can't say that there's anything out there that's in the public domain, nothing that's, you know, as significant maybe as what Peter Boyles is representing.
Okay.
Unless I missed it.
Let's go to Cynic here. I know Cynic has probably got a million questions, and I have a couple of questions from the chat room after Cynic. Cynic, go ahead.
Well, I just thought I'd take a little bit of a time out to slam Paula Woodward because, you know.
Okay, go ahead.
She deserves it, for starters. But with respect to Paula and her book, well, I guess to say that, you know, she has the cooperation of the Ramses would be somewhat of an understatement since she's been a Ramsey shill and a lapdog for so many years. But I guess it all started, for those that don't happen to know, with pretty early on, there was a group of seven handpicked reporters that were gathered in a top secret mm-hmm. at a top secret time and place, just a day after the first official interviews with the Ramseys by the Boulder Police Department. So on May 1st, 1997, she was one of seven that were picked, and there were very strict rules in terms of what the people could ask, and they were not allowed to ask, for example, about any substantive facts about JonBenet's murder. They could not identify any of the Ramsey attorneys in the room. They were even given a secret code word to get access into the hotel room, I believe, if I recall correctly. So. And it all started off there, and her big question, if the stories are all correct, her big question to the Ramseys was, how's Burke doing? So that was her hard-hitting question.
Her hard-hitting question, right.
At the interview, and it continued on. You know, she did a bunch of powder puff pieces, throughout the years, and then I guess her big payoff from the Ramseys and I suppose was the big tip off about John Mark Carr, as she was the one that broke that
mm-hmm.
the big story. So yeah, it's I guess Michael Tracy and the Ramseys, that was their big gift to Paula, and that's just the way it's been for her, and I'm sure that
turned out to
be a
travesty. Yeah, it turned out exactly. The John Mark Carr, he was the one that was arrested a few years back by Mary Lacey, claiming that he was the killer, and they were so sure they got him, and they let Paula Woodward have that exclusive, and it was not an exclusive at all. I'll never forget that. I came out and said, he's not the killer, he didn't do it, and everybody attacked me, and I'm like, just wait and see. It didn't happen. I went on national TV and said that, and people were just appalled. I'm like, Mary Lacey is an idiot. She's just believing what Michael Tracy is telling her, and they've got got these stupid emails, and that's it. And Paula Woodward, any good journalist would not have run with that story with what they had, because it was a joke. If little old me here, you know, outside of Park City, Utah, in Wanship, Utah, can figure that out, then you would think an educated, you know, pro like Paula Woodward could. And she couldn't. She just grabbed onto it and went with it. They had the killer. Well, no. And this book will be a travesty. Oh, go ahead, Sinek. Go ahead.
I was just going to add that in that interview, that was the interview where John Ramsey just happened to say that he was asked, what do you want to say to the killer of your daughter? That question was not asked by Paula, by the way. And he said, we will find you. We will find you. I have that as the sole mission for the rest of my life. And then the reporter, Mrs. Ramsey, and she said likewise. And then actually this is from Chief Kohler's book, where he reproduced a letter to Alex Hunter. This, I believe, April the 11th, 1998, a letter to Alex Hunter saying that I'm living my life for two purposes now, to find the killer of JonBenet and bring it to the maximum justice that our society can impose. I'd just like to add that, of course, he had nothing to say when the true bill of indictment information was released. The Fair Justice Foundation, which he, you know, loosely operated for a number of years, that's no longer active. John Ramsey doesn't even pretend to care anymore. And
you're right.
It's unbelievable. He couldn't even utter a comment about, you know, the indictment. And this is something which actually was brought out by a number of people, brought up by some people on the forums, brought up by Peter Boyles as well. Just some of the information from the Death of Innocence, when Alex Hunter shamelessly went out and said that that they were not going to be moving forward, and kept from the public the fact that the jury did actually vote to indict.
Mm-hmm.
From the Death of Innocence, he says the following: Patsy hugged me and stood there in relief, staring at the television screen. People would have to finally see the jury's decision as our vindication. I was so choked up, I was ready to cry. We weren't going to jail. And then later he says, after looking at the evidence or lack of it, a jury of our peers had not indicted Patsy and me. It seemed the system had functioned as our Constitution had intended. We were truly grateful.
Uh-huh.
So he had something to say back then, but nothing to say now.
Exactly. And to, again, silence in this case speaks just mega, mega pounds of golden silence speaks so loudly. And that's true. John, I want to give you an example. Think about if any of this stuff happened to Mark Klass. You know, if there was an indictment that came down that he had something to do with his daughter's death, he'd be so out in front of the cameras raging. When you compare him to other parents, it is shameful how they have treated the memory of their daughter. Strangers care more about the memory of their daughter. And here's the thing. Hypothetical here, okay? Let's say hypothetically that Burke Ramsey did do it. If I was in that position, I would have called the police and gotten my son help, and, you know, thank God, and I'm not. But I don't think there's anybody that wouldn't understand the Ramseys wanting to cover it up. They would maybe not agree with it, but understand it if they were trying to protect their only living son. However, it is when they threw their best friends, Fleet and Priscilla White, under the bus, Steve Thomas, all kinds of innocent people under the bus to protect themselves. That's the problem I have with what the Ramseys have done. I don't know what happened that night in the house. I hope maybe someday before I die we'll find out for sure. But I'm sorry, I'm getting on my soapbox here. Let me climb down because we do have some questions here. This is from Michael. Chief Kohler, do you have any idea if, because of how the Ramsey case was handled by the Boulder Police Department, has anything changed? Do they handle things differently, especially if it's a high-profile case? Do you know of anything specifically?
I couldn't say of anything specifically, but I think there were a lot of lessons learned from the initial handling of the case. And I've said this repeatedly on other occasions during other interviews, is that, yes, there are mistakes, I think, that people acknowledge from their initial response, but they picked up the ball pretty quickly after that and investigated it like no other case I think I've ever seen. And I'm sure that those lessons have long been burned into their memory banks and
yes.
not forgotten about how to handle major crimes.
We do have a question from a caller calling in. I don't know who this is, so we're risking it here, people. But, hey, we like to live dangerously on Trisha's True Crime Radio. Area code 281, you are on the air with Chief James Kohler. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Trisha. Hello, Mr. Kohler. Hey, this is OTG on Web Sleuth, and I've got a question I'd really like to know. Have the police considered when the 911 call was made whether or not it could have been made from another phone other than the one that the Ramseys claimed? There's a photograph, and it was taken down in the basement. It shows a telephone laying on a utility table, but it was taken, it's not a crime scene photo, it was taken after they left. It was obviously after they had moved out because it was tidy. And I just wondered if they had considered, because I don't understand how a wall phone could be hung up and not fall to the table below if it wasn't hung up properly.
Good question. That's a very good question. Chief Kohler?
I don't recall seeing any other phones in the basement, any active phones or any phones. I have to go back and look at the crime scene photos to see what you're referring to.
But don't you think... go ahead.
I was going to say that, you know, I don't think you would necessarily see the phone fall to the countertop if it wasn't directly engaged or hanging up properly. It could still be sitting cockeyed in the receiver and not be disconnecting the line without having to actually fall out of the cradle.
Chief Kohler, to follow up on that,
Can
we follow up on that question real quickly? Did everybody just take the Ramsey's word that that's where the phone call was made, was from that kitchen phone on the wall?
Well, my understanding was from a landline phone, and that's where the Ramseys said that they called. That's where the ransom note was spread out on the floor, where John was supposedly, you know, leaning over it and kneeling over it and reading it, and when he instructed Patsy to call. I don't know if it'd make any difference as to what room of the house it was called from, because it'd all still be presumably the same landline. I don't think they had any different numbers
right.
running into the home other than, you know, the wireless cell phones, obviously. But I'm not quite sure if that makes any difference.
Well,
as to,
if
it's downstairs
add,
or yeah.
Yes,
if
go
I
ahead.
Add to that,
go ahead.
If the phone call was made from the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And if Burke's voice could be heard on the phone, it means that they were all down there in the basement before they called the police.
Interesting. That does make a difference. You're right. If Burke's voice is on the phone and if it was from the basement, they were all down there, and they swore they weren't down there until John went down to discover her body. Caller, I did not catch your username on Web Sleuth. What did you say?
Trisha, this is OTG.
Oh, hi, OTG. Okay. Oh, this is. We love OTG. He's a great guy. Very smart. So, yeah, that's a very good point. That would change a lot, because if they were in the basement, then they obviously all knew what was going on.
Did the investigators do any testing of that phone to see if it would continue to hold the line if it wasn't hung up, or if it was on the cradle?
Not that I'm aware of, you know, but it was a live phone line, so if it had not been set properly in the cradle, you know, it would stay open for whatever period of time before it finally fell into place by gravity, I presume.
In the interrogations, they asked, and Patsy was pretty quick to answer that it was the kitchen phone.
Mm-hmm. OTG, do you have any other questions?
If I get a bingo, do I get another question?
Sure. You got bingo. What's your other question?
Okay. There are two versions of the 911 call that have been released publicly, and they both have obviously been tampered with. Would it be possible for an unaltered version of the 911 call to be released?
I certainly think that's possible. Not long after my book was released, I had email correspondence with someone who was providing me a digital version of the 911 tape. And I kept asking them, what's the source of this tape? Because they were claiming that some other type of wordage was being heard on it. And I never could get a definitive answer as to what the source was. So, I mean, in today's day and age, you know, with the electronics and computer capabilities, I'm certain that someone could fabricate a 911 call and put it out there and claim it to be authentic.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So is there any, like, Freedom of Information Act? I mean, this is a legal question, but could there be any claim that a little old member of the public could ask for an unedited, untouched version of this from the DA's office? Is that possible?
That's, again, a good legal question. You know, being an active, even though cold case murder investigation, mm-hmm. you might not be successful in obtaining that. I couldn't say whether or not you'd be able to do that or not. Again, that's a question for an attorney.
Yeah, I think we need to get ourselves a good attorney there in Boulder. Maybe they could help us out. OTG, thank you. We adore you and love you, and thank you for calling in. We do have a question from the chat room. Cubby wanted to know, do you know what Burke is doing now, and how he is doing now?
The last I heard about a year ago, is my understanding he was working as some computer IT support person, that he was, I think, still in the Indiana area, and that's about as much as I know. I really haven't kept tabs on him.
Let's go around the table one more time here, because Chief Kohler, believe it or not, does have a life. It doesn't revolve around answering questions for us nonstop, although it should, but we do let him go occasionally. He does have to run. So, Cold Case, your final question, please.
Oh, well, you know, following up on the issues with the phone calls from the 911 call, there were a couple of things that I always was a little fuzzy about, and one was that there were detectives, and you've read the report, so you would know, Chief Kohler, who used the Ramsey's cell phones because they claimed their batteries were dead, which I thought was a very clever way to look at their call listing, possibly. Not that that mm-hmm. happened. But so I just wondered if in those reports you found anything interesting like that.
Cold case, I really couldn't tell you. Things were fairly hectic there that day. I think the officers and detectives were corresponding and communicating by cell phone versus radio. I don't remember batteries going dead, although that's, you know, certainly possible or feasible. And I think the 911 call initially was made by Fleet White, if I recall, after JonBenet's body had been found, and it ended up going to a different dispatch center outside of Boulder County. So I don't know I can't remember if that got transferred or if another call was made that ended up finally ending up at the Boulder Communications Center or not, but that was Fleet's phone as well. I'm sorry, I just don't remember those details.
That's the best we can do. Go ahead, Cold Case.
Well, one thing I wondered also, once Patsy made her 911 call, and I can't really remember having this firmly answered for me, because even though Boulder was a medium-sized police department that had very few murders that they dealt with, it was still 1996, and I wondered why they sent marked police cars and officers to the home to respond to a kidnapping call that morning.
Well, the marked patrol units are the first, you know, line of response in every department. It's not likely, given the time of day and year, that they had unmarked detectives working in the street at the time. They were probably either off duty or on days off or vacation, whatever the case might be. Boulder at that time, I don't think, had a 24-hour detective on duty. They cover a lot of different hours, but at that time, I don't think that that was the case. So, you know, if you're responding to a crime that has occurred, you've got a missing child, your patrolling is going to be the first one that's going to be responding to the scene to make an assessment of what's happening and determine if there's actually a kidnapping or just a missing child that's fallen asleep somewhere else in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, that's not unusual for a marked patrol unit to be the first on scene in those types of circumstances.
Okay, even though, boy, it's been so long, I can't remember. Didn't they say that on the 911 call that if you say anything or you call the police that we'll behead her? Even though that was given to the 911 operator, it didn't register and they just showed up in the police car because you would think that maybe they would try not to, but I don't know. I can't remember what was said on the 911 call.
I'd have to look at the transcript. I don't remember that being mentioned during the 911 call about the beheading or anything like that.
I can't remember.
I'd have to look at it.
Cold Case, thank you very, very much, my dear. I just put you on hold for a minute, but I wanted to let you know how much we appreciate you calling in. And Michael in Minnesota, my wonderful co-host, you do have a question for Chief James Kohler, author of the amazing book about JonBenet Ramsey, a foreign faction who really kidnapped JonBenet. And Michael, go ahead.
Chief Kohler, this is probably a question everyone wants to know. But do you believe in our lifetime there will ever be a resolution to the JonBenet Ramsey murder?
Good question.
I would like to think so. It seems that the truth in this case comes out in a piecemeal fashion, and I hold high hopes that at some juncture this will be resolved to everyone's satisfaction. So that's my belief.
Oh, let's
hope
so.
I hope you're right. Yeah, and my second question has to do with this Sid Wells case that I never heard of, and that Skypulty thing, whatever his name was.
Mm-hmm.
What is there ever going to be a continuation? Is that a cold case, or has it just been neglected, or what is the status of that case? Do you have any idea, and will we see, again, a resolution to that case?
Well, it's my understanding that an arrest warrant has been issued for Thane Smyka on murder charges. He's, you know, fallen off the radar. I don't know if there's an ongoing effort to determine, you know, where he's last been located, either through credit cards or any other type of background information you might be able to trace, because it's been such a long time since that murder took place. And I don't know if that's going to come to resolution or not, unless he gets picked up. He could have changed his name and living under an alias somewhere, or he could have, you know, passed away. I don't think they've found anything as far as any record of his death under that name. So that's hard to say. But the warrant's outstanding. If he ever is contacted by law enforcement and his name is run, he'll show up as a wanted person out of Boulder, Colorado.
One can only hope. Michael,
yeah,
go ahead.
Were his fingerprints ever entered into CODIS, or were they able to ever get them? I know that this happened before CODIS, but do we have his fingerprints?
Well, CODIS is the DNA database.
Sorry.
That's okay. And you know, AFIS, the automatic finger indexing system, identification system. I don't know if he has been arrested where his fingerprints are being on file. I just don't remember if he had any type of criminal record. So I'm not sure if that's a way to positively identify him either some juncture if he's contacted in the future.
Boy, he lucked out. He really did. Michael, thank you very much. I'm going to let Cynic, the one and only amazing Cynic, wrap up our conversation with Chief James Kohler today with his final question. Cynic, go ahead.
I don't know if I really have a question per se. I just wanted to sort of I suppose, kind of go to one of my posts on Forums for Justice where
okay.
I dubbed it A Christmas Wish for 2014.
Let's hear it.
Okay, well, I'll just read it out here. Essentially, I hope that 2014 will be as illuminating as 2013 has been in terms of justice for JonBenet. 2013 brought news that the case had indeed been solved. Of course, it's been solved by many throughout the years, by Steve Thomas and James Kohler, to name two. Yes, we don't know the specifics, and there is disagreement on details, but we know the truth. The solution to this nearly two-decade-old mystery is not to be found by hunting for Lou Smith's imaginary intruder or following Mary Lacey's DNA-driven delusions. It was, as John Ramsey once rightly said, an inside job. A grand jury in 1999 tried to lay a foundation that would bring some degree of justice to JonBenet, but the spark was quickly extinguished by Alex Hunter. I hope that 2014 will be the year that someone will find a way to punish Alex Hunter for lying to the public and its courts. Rest in peace, JonBenet.
That's very well put. Very well put. Thank you, Cynic. Thank you. And people like you who continue to hang on and continue to go over the evidence and go over the new evidence, JonBenet is not forgotten. That's for sure, Cynic. Thank you very much. That was absolutely lovely. Chief Kohler, what are you doing now? I mean, you do have a real job. You have a big job. You're the police chief of Telluride, Colorado. That is certainly a very active ski town. So what are your plans for 2014?
Keep on plugging along. I've given consideration to writing a little bit more for another edition of Foreign Faction. I was thinking of
writing
a chapter regarding the grand jury information.
Yes, do
and
it.
Also, I'd sent you and Cynic, I think, a photocopy of some text and some photos out of a medical legal investigation text written by Dr. Warner Spitz. And that had some depictions of JonBenet's skull injury matching up to the flashlight. And I thought that that might be a nice addition to put into the book. I recently got permission from him to use that should I decide to go forward and do some additional writing on Foreign Faction. So that's something I've been considering doing. I can't say what the timing of that would be, but that is something I thought might be of interest to people.
I think you have a huge audience here that would be very interested in that, and we'll help you any way we can, Chief Kohler. You know that, right?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chief Kohler. Thank you so much. Give my best to your family, and thank you for taking time away from your Sunday evening to join us. You take care, okay?
Okay. Thank you, and have a safe holiday.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Wow, Michael. Isn't he amazing?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
He is just, I hope he writes that those couple of extra chapters, because that would really, I mean, that would pick up book sales again. I just think it's important for anybody who has any question about the case to read this book. Now, one thing I think we have to remember, my friends, is some people are just stuck on the intruder theory, and you could have a videotape of the crime and they'd still say it was an intruder. You just got to roll by those people, just scroll by them mentally, just let them roll off your back and just keep looking at the truth, and I think the truth will finally eventually come out, as Chief Kohler says it will. I happen to believe that as well. Okay, my friends, that wraps it up today. Today's show is sponsored by the incredible organization called Paws for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Paws for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. I'm telling you, this organization is amazing. Go to www.pawsforpurpleheartsorg. Okay, everybody got their plastic over your heads? Are you ready? the final legal goo for the year 2013. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. So in other words, my darling crime-fighting angels, if you find yourself all in a mad wad about something that was said on this radio show, you don't take it out on the forums. You come to yours truly, Trisha. That's the Trisha in Trisha's True Crime Radio. Everybody have a very safe holiday, and we'll see you next year. Michael, thank you for all your help. Good night, everybody.